Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Updates. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the charges Gary City Council President Ron Brewer is facing. Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill has officially launched his re-election bid, and Chris Nolte has a conversation with Regional Health Systems President and CEO Bob Crumweed. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Updates. The president of the Gary City Council faces charges alleging he kidnapped a 14-year-old boy he believed was involved in stealing his car. Ronald Brewer was charged with kidnapping, criminal confinement, and intimidation. Prosecutors have told the Times that the boy in question isn't believed to have been involved in the September theft. Police have said Brewer tracked down his stolen vehicle to East Chicago, firing a gun at the teens inside it and taking the 14-year-old boy against his will into Gary. Since his arrest following the incident, Brewer has maintained his innocence, and his attorney and other supporters have said he had the right to make a citizen's arrest. However, critics say he should have let the police handle the matter. Brewer was re-elected last Tuesday.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
U.S. Steel has laid off an undisclosed number of non-union workers nationwide, including at Gary Works and the Midwest plant in Portage. The latest round of layoffs is on top of the 150 workers the Pittsburgh-based steelmaker plans to let go when it idles East Chicago 10 later this year. U.S. Steel has been looking to slash annual costs by $200 million a year after poor financial performance amid deteriorating market conditions, including weak steel prices, soft demand, declining automotive sales, and a record $31 billion in household and kitchen appliance imports last year. The company won't say how many workers it has let go, but said they are not union-represented hourly workers, meaning those affected all worked in managerial or professional positions. U.S. Steel lost $84 million in the third quarter, or 49 cents per share, down from $291 million in profit during the third quarter of last year. The company has idled Blast Furnace No. 8 at Gary Works and soon will idle East Chicago 10, consolidating its 10-making operations at Gary Works and the Midwest plant. U.S. Steel laid off managerial staff at Gary Works in 2016 when it cut 750 non-union workers nationwide, roughly a fourth of its salaried workforce at the time.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb isn't promising any quick action on the call for further boosting teacher pay that thousands of educators will be making at the Statehouse next week. Teacher unions say at least 107 school districts with more than 40% of Indiana students will be closed Tuesday while their teachers attend the rally. Holcomb didn't criticize school districts for closing the day of the union-organized rally, saying it was a local decision. The Republican governor said Thursday he applauds teachers for expressing their concerns, but he's waiting for a teacher pay commission he appointed to make recommendations by the end of next year. The rally, dubbed Red for Ed Action Day, will happen on the day legislators are gathering for organization meetings ahead of their 2020 session.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Indiana Republican Attorney General Curtis Hill, who's been accused of sexual misconduct by five women, officially announced his re-election bid Thursday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brenda Smith reports Hill faces challenges next year from both sides of the aisle.
I've stood with President Trump, and I'll never back down from partisan attacks, the media, and even Republicans embarrassed to defend our values.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Sending a child to overnight camp can be nerve-wracking for any parent. It's even scarier if they have a child with a chronic illness. As Side Effects Public Media's Steph Whitesad reports, a camp in Illinois offers a safe option for kids who have type 1 diabetes.
Okay, ready? Follow me, okay? Put your hand down. Get some more.
In the rolling hills of southern Illinois, stable hands get ready to lead a trail ride. Campers get a quick lesson and they're off, but not before counselors collect backpacks full of medical supplies.
You got the brakes on. There you go.
There you go.
Hold by the knot, sweetie.
The backpacks show how Camp Beta is different from traditional summer camps. Counselors are dietetic students from Southern Illinois University, and the 26 kids are always accompanied by a nurse and a dietitian.
Our priority is to just let these kids come out and be kids and have fun and do some things that maybe they're not able to do all the time, ride horses, go zip lining, kayaking, things like that, while we're kind of helping them learn how to do these things and still remain safe with type 1 diabetes.
That's diabetic educator and nurse Lisa Nation. She and her colleagues came up with the idea for the camp. Camp Beta is the only camp for type 1 kids in southern Illinois. It's a short one, only 2 days, but unlike longer camps, it's free.
But there's quite a big cost associated with for the families with those longer camps. So we really wanted to make this inclusive for everyone in our region.
Because kids with type 1 diabetes don't produce any insulin, they rely on injections or an insulin pump to provide it. They need to test their blood sugar and adjust the dose based on food or activity, or risk going into diabetic shock. Amy Stout helped develop the camp, and she says it can be tough for parents to let go, even for a couple days.
The camp itself is for kids that often don't get a chance to go overnight with their friends even, because diabetes is well known to have low blood sugar reactions in the middle of the night.
That can make parents wary of letting their kids out of sight, especially when they can't be sure other adults know how to handle a diabetic emergency. Billy Crippen says Camp Beta is the only camp her daughter has attended, though she wants to go to others.
She's asked, church camp is actually right down the road from here, and she's asked to go, and it makes me a nervous wreck.
Daughter Taylor says she enjoys meeting other kids like her.
Just meeting all the people with diabetes like me and just like having somebody that knows what it feels like. I'm the only one at school that has diabetes, but...
Stout said that shared experience is a goal of Camp Beta. Kids can feel embarrassed about checking their blood sugar and taking insulin before they can eat. But at camp, she's seen kids change, including one girl who didn't want to wear her insulin pump.
Where she brought her insulin pens because she was going to kind of hide them and, you know, go into the bathroom, take her injections and come out to eat. And then when she saw all the rest of the kids were using their insulin pumps, she was like, oh, why didn't I bring my pump, you know?
Camp is also a break for parents who help their children manage the disease. That can be like having a full-time job. It's a task that doesn't stop, even at night, says Crippen.
When everybody else is tired, wants to wind down and go to sleep, somebody has to be vigilant in the night.
That can get tiring for parents and kids. Taylor admits that she sometimes avoids telling her parents when she has a low, though her younger sister often tells them for her.
There are some moments when I'm trying to hide my low so I could just do what normal kids normally just get to do.
And getting to have that kind of normal kid experience, even if it's only for a couple of days, is what Camp Beta is all about. Steph Whiteside for Side Effects Public Media.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's Regionally Speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Bob Crumweed.
Our next guest here on Regionally Speaking is a fellow who is stepping down. He's retiring from his position as the CEO, president and CEO, actually, of Regional Health Systems. Bob Crumweed has been in the organization for 30 years. And it's nice to have him in the studio to talk about the time that he has spent here in Northwest Indiana with such an important organization as RHS. And thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
If you will, tell us about first, I guess, maybe going all the way back, a little bit about your background, which you did a little bit earlier, but about how your background got you into this position in the first place.
Sure. A lot of it is just happenstance. I had every anticipation of getting into the school of medicine and becoming a physician, and then discovered I didn't like chemistry, which was an ugly fit. So I ended up going to the School of Medicine anyway. They had a program then in hospital administration, and the idea was you could spend some time there and maybe go into the School of Medicine or the School of Dentistry. And remembering that I didn't like chemistry, I decided to stay in the School of Hospital Administration that IU had at that point in time. And I got placed in a hospital for my residency in Omaha, Nebraska. And the week before I was supposed to show up, I called to ask where I was supposed to show up. And they had fired the proctor that I was supposed to be working under. And so I had to find someplace really quick for another residency because I had 2 weeks to do it or I was going to have to sit out of school for another year. So I called the father of a friend of mine from Newcastle who happened to be the commissioner of mental health for the state of Indiana, Dr. William Murray, and he placed me out at LaRue Carter Hospital. Mm-hmm. And so everything just kind of snowballed after that. And, you know, it's one of those things where most wonderful set of catastrophic issues that ever hit my life, and I just never left. So from 1978 forward, I've been in the mental health field. Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little about LaRue Carter Hospital. That's a unique place in its own. There are a number of hospitals around the state like LaRue Carter in the system. There's one, the LaRue Carter. There's one in Richmond. There are a number of other cities around the state that have, I guess, what the sad some people call mental health facilities, but some people call them insane asylums, which is the bad way to put it because that's not always the way. But we know that in history, that's the way they've been viewed.
Absolutely. And there's fewer now than there used to be. You know, when I worked for the Department of Mental Health, and I was down there for 4 years too, we had close to, I want to say, 20,000 residents there. We now have under 700. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's and they're spread out among four. Let's see, there's Richmond, there's Evansville, there's Logansport, and then there's the one in Indianapolis, and that's the and Madison. So there's five facilities now, and there used to be seven, and there used to be five facilities for folks who are developmentally disabled, and they're all gone. So that's changed a lot over the years.
What did you find when you were able to come up here to Northwest Indiana, since you were down in Indianapolis, an area that you liked about what was up here, and how much of a good fit did it seem to be to get involved with, which is now the regional mental health services systems?
Well, at the time, it was a fit of necessity. I worked for the Department of Mental Health and spent some time actually as acting commissioner under the Robert Orr administration. And you might remember there was an election then, and the Republican was defeated, and Evan Bayh became the new governor. And I actually had gone to school with Evan, so I knew him. But it was clear that because I worked for a Republican, I needed to move on.
Right.
And so there were only two jobs available at the time, and I had a family, so I needed to find one. One of them was in Terre Haute, and the other one was up here. And I decided to come up here only because I could come in earlier, and it seemed like a better option for me. Frankly, the person that ran the facility before left under less than desirable purposes or circumstances. And one of the things I have learned throughout my career, it's always best to follow somebody that didn't do so well. You don't pale by comparison that mm-hmm. way. And it's worked out wonderful for me.
What did you find when you came in? First, let's ask, what was the organization that you came into at first, and what did you find when you stepped into that position?
I came into Tri-City Mental Health Center in mm-hmm. East Chicago, and its past executive director had some issues, ended up in the Federal Witness Protection Program, actually. But what I found was a staff that was really delightful and really wanted to do the right thing and really was depressed because of the pale that was cast over them by these other issues. And these folks worked so hard and were so committed to the folks that they were treating that it was exactly what we wanted when I worked for the Department of Mental Health. We wanted folks that were very individually oriented, bent on getting folks back into the community, and wanted to do the right thing. And they were all up there. It was really a unique program.
What did you finally get to do as some of your first expansion plans that kind of brought things along? And bring us up to date to where we are today, please.
Well, with everything in the world, you know, it's like a big clock. The hand just keeps turning, but it comes back to the fore every once in a while. And when I was there, substance abuse was a big ticket item in the state of Indiana. There was a large need for substance abuse facilities, primarily for alcoholism, but also for cocaine was a big drug of choice. There's always been heroin in the system, but that wasn't a big ticket item. And up at Tri-City, we then ended up opening up 45 beds to treat folks with chronic substance abuse issues. At that point in time, the state paid for the services, and we never had an empty bed. We usually had a waiting list of probably 3 to 4 weeks for somebody to get into one of those beds. And that was a great service, and it was one of three in the state of Indiana, one in Indianapolis and another in Evansville. And so we kind of focused on that, and at that time point in time also, folks were realizing that folks with mental illness might be addicted too. And so we had a really big cross population of folks that had chronic and seriously persistent mental illness who were also addicted. And so we kind of carved that niche out for us ourselves too, and kind of rode that wave for a while. Also opened a lot of group homes. Those group homes were a new issue in the state of Indiana at that point in time. And it was extraordinarily difficult to find a community that would welcome a group home. I remember I was going to put a group home in East Chicago next to a bar that had a kind of a sully reputation. Its nickname was the Bucket of Blood. The priest shows up to remonstrate against me because he thought I was going to degrade the neighborhood. You know, the bar wasn't, but I was. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, we had a really great director of housing in East Chicago, John Artis, who's a super guy. And John saw this going on and found another spot for us in East Chicago, and we've just kind of built on that since then.
Bring us to where Geminis Corporation fits into the picture, and I know that's part of the expansion that's gone into where we are today.
Sure. What happened was Lee Strawn, who was the director at the Southlake at the time, and I would ride down to Indianapolis a lot because we both happened to be on the board of our trade association at that point in time. And we both started talking about how hard it was for us to take care of the administrative burden that we were feeling and how we had to find ways to cut our costs. And so on one of the trips, we decided, well, maybe we could combine all of our administrative duties into one job and share them between the two of us. So as a result, we opened up Geminis there in Pine Island in Merivale, and it was a relatively small shop, but it did all the back room activities for the two mental health centers, accounts receivable, IT services, HR services, all that good stuff, medical records. And so we developed that program. About 4 years into it, the Head Start program in Indiana went up for bid. They weren't happy with their current provider. We threw our hat in the ring, just feeling like, you know, that's something we could do. And we might be able to do it pretty well, and we really didn't expect to get the grant, and sure, so that meant we were going to get it, and we did get it, and we've started running the Head Start service too, and then we started doing lots of social services in the community, and Geminis has grown from a group of what I think was originally 20 employees up to about 300 now, doing everything that's just short of therapeutic services for the community, do a lot of work for DCS and folks like that.
What type of feedback have you gotten over the years from folks locally and even folks in Indianapolis about how things have gone up here and the expansion and how the services that was just now all part of the region has turned out?
Like most areas, actually better than most areas, we get very good feedback on what we do. You know, we have a dedicated staff. We now provide primary health care services too through HRSA, and that's important because the reality is folks with chronic mental illness die 20 years earlier than the rest of the population, but they don't die because of their mental illness. They die because of physical illnesses that have gone unattended because of their mental illness. You know, they can't run the gamut of where they need to go to get their physical health care taken care of. So our board of directors about 10 years ago took it upon themselves to see if we couldn't get into the primary care business, and we do that now. And we have clinics in each of our major mental health settings too. And so our clients don't have to leave the building to get their health care attended to. We go find them. And so it's really worked out great. You know, folks with diabetes is a big thing in the chronically mentally ill field, and we can keep that under control. We we also have dentists. So we give them the whole nine yards here. We're really we are literally a whole person activity, and we have all the providers under roof.
Is there any area, since you've been able to encompass so much now into the regional regional health systems now, which is the name, including all of these things that are go beyond mental health and treatment and diagnosis, are there any other areas that you think that the you can fit into now, as the organization can fit into maybe for the future? Are you pretty much happy with what you've got and you need to just kind of fine-tune it a bit?
Well, in general, it is a fine-tuning issue, but it's always been a fine-tuning issue. One of the things that we're really focusing on now is we're one of two centers in the state, and I think 20 nationwide, who got a grant for the Certified Community Mental Health Center system. It's a federal grant where you do everything for the client, and you get a flat fee to serve these folks. And so right now what we're in the process of doing is hiring more healthcare folks and training our behavioral health care folks to be able to do basic biometric measures while they're doing case management services with folks in their home. So we can stay on top of what's going on with their blood sugars. We can stay on top in terms of what's going on with their blood pressure, all in one visit. Because the reality is these folks have an awful lot on their plate. And when we go to do a home visit, we get about 20 minutes of productive time out of a 40-minute visit. Because the first 10, they want to tell us how their week went. The second 10, they want to tell us what they're doing the next week. And so we got that 20-minute period there where we've got to get the information we need out of these folks. And in some cases, it's how come you're not taking your blood pressure medication? It's through the roof. Or other cases, you know, it's clear you're not taking your psychotropic medication by your rambling, just like I am right now, behavior here.
Only you're not on the medication, though.
I'm not. That's right.
There's so much to cover in just a short period of time that we have together to talk, to be sure. Also, too, I can't let you go without talking a little bit about the honors that you picked up. And interestingly enough, you got picked up from your old boss, too.
That's right.
And I'm referring to the going all the way back to the Distinguished Hoosier Award that you received from then-Governor Robert Orr.
Yep. If you hang around long enough, they always give you a piece of paper. And that's what happened here. Governor Orr, we actually done a lot of work with what we call the assertive case management program in Indiana, where we took folks that were most fragile as it related to their mental health status, left them in the community, but we kind of put a big brother with them to watch them all the time. And it was a team, so that nobody ever got burnt out. And so in recognition of that and working with the same kind of system with kids, he gave me a Distinguished Hoosier Award. And then Evan Bay was kind enough when I left, I think it was just to get rid of me, made me a Sagamore of the Wabash. And that was impressive. I've got to admit, I'm not sure I ever really deserved that, but I still have it on my wall and I'm not taking it down.
I would imagine probably that he has referred to a number of people and having you on the list for that, the award in particular, said, well, what's this guy done? You know, and he's done this, this, and this, and this, and he's taken this organization that started out just as a facility in East Chicago all the way up to where it is today over in Northwest Indiana, and in turn has been able to make the improvements over the time that you'd been in office before up to getting the award. And the award we're, of course, referring to is the Sagamore the Wabash Award, and not many people have it out
there. They don't.
And luckily, a lot of people that have it certainly do treasure the award, and I'm sure that you do.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about the future now, and the fellow who that they have chosen, your board of directors have chosen to take over now that you're going to retire, and you get to break in somebody new. Well, he's not new. I should not say that's true. Bill Trowbridge has been around for a while, I understand.
He has, and most recently he's been running the Michiana Industries in LaPorte County and Paladin here in Lake County and also in LaPorte County, which is a service for folks that are developmentally disabled and or intellectually disabled. You used to call them MR folks, mentally retarded. Now it's DD, ID. Mm-hmm. And he's ran that service for, I think, the last 4 years, and he's crossing over into our service area. Delightful guy. Is an attorney by training. That's the only fault I find in them.
Well, it's always the case, you know, sometimes the people that are meant to be in certain industries turn out to have education backgrounds that are certainly maybe completely different from what they did before, too.
So. Well, I have an attorney. My son's an attorney, so I don't.
So you can't.
I gotta watch what I say.
You can't badmouth the bar too much. I know.
But he's great. He'll do well.
Have you had a chance to work with him, or has he come in yet? I know he doesn't start really until next month.
We're staying in communication, so that you know he knows what's going on, and he'll start with the organization on the 16th of December, mm-hmm. and it'll be kind of up to he and I as to how long I hang around then to fill in the voids for him. I don't think it'll take long. He knows a little bit about this field, and he's a quick learner. And he certainly knows where the Department of Mental Health is because that's where he gets his funding too.
Well, Bob, thank you for spending time with us talking about history, about the importance of how the regional health systems started out as just a small organization and grown into the one that it is today and the one that is so encompassing and in helping in many ways the mental as well as physical health of so many people here in Northwest Indiana. And we appreciate you taking time with us to talk about it.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
We've been talking today with Bob Crumweed, who is retiring and soon to step down as being the president and CEO of the Regional Health Systems here in Northwest Indiana. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Program consideration comes from Lithographic Communication.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.